This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. When was the last time you ate a bagel, or gave a spiel at work, or called someone a klutz, or tried to show some chutzpah, or contacted Apple about an iPhone glitch? Well, these might feel like quintessential examples of being a modern American, but the keywords behind them aren't. They're Yiddish. The Jewish people began speaking Yiddish over 1,000 years ago in Eastern Europe. But after a century and a half of immigration to the United States and elsewhere around the world, the cultural reach of the language is vast. These days, most everyone, including goys, feel some connection to Yiddish.
My parents spoke Yiddish, but they only spoke it when they didn't want us to understand a word they were saying.
I would call anyone who spoke too much a yenta.
Yiddish was a live verbal scripture, tethering me to my roots in the shtetl.
I once had a Jewish mother-in-law, and she employed many Yiddishes. I used the word mishkat for messes, for whatever. I find it very useful.
My mother used to tell me when I was young, the Yiddish word for head lice is vants, and she used to say I had vants.
I saw Blazing Saddles, and Mel Brooks yelled out, Luzzum Gang. In the entire university movie theater, one person laughed. Me.
It makes two of us because I laugh too. God, I love that scene. Just a few of the stories that you left in our inbox. Joining us now to talk about the comeback of Yiddish in America are the co-editors of a new collection of essays about the language called How Yiddish Changed America and How America Changed Yiddish. Ilan Stavins is a professor of humanities, Latin American, and Latino culture at Amherst College, and he's with me on the line from San Francisco. Professor Stavins, welcome to 1A.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And Josh Lambert is the academic director of the Yiddish Book Center and an American literature professor at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He joins us from New England Public Radio in Amherst. Professor Lambert, welcome to you.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Well, Professor Lambert, let's start with a basic question for those who don't know much about Yiddish. What is it? Where did it come from? And who speaks it these days?
Sure. It's important to know that even though it's familiar from, you know, random words here and there in American language, Yiddish is a language like any other that's been around for a long time. The first texts we have in Yiddish come from about the year 1200, and we know that most Jews who lived throughout Europe spoke Yiddish for hundreds and hundreds of years. Today, we tend to say that there's it's hard to estimate, but at least about 400,000 people in the world who speak Yiddish as a daily language. So it's, still very much a vibrant part of Jewish culture all over the world.
Is it mostly German in terms of dialect, or is it more complex than that?
There's a lot of different pieces of it. If you speak German, you'll recognize a lot of German when you hear Yiddish, but there are also old French roots in it and other Latin roots in it. There are lots of Slavic elements, and then a big part of the language comes from Hebrew, from Semitic languages. So it's a sort of fusion language that brings in all those elements.
You know, for a long time, Yiddish has been attached to this idea of the dead language, or at least the dying language. You're saying that's not true.
Yeah, and on some level, it's never been true. I mean, we're living in a moment where there's so much excitement about Yiddish, where a Yiddish production of Fiddler on the Roof was getting raves on Broadway. But that's sort of always been the case in America. There's always been a lot of pop culture interest in Yiddish, at least for the last 100 or 150 years. And there's always been people speaking it, raising their families in it, using it for all sorts of purposes. So I think that, it's a little bit sad or mistaken to think of it as a language that, is somehow dead, or disappeared, because it never really did, even though it suffered some very difficult moments in history.
Well, Ilan Stavins, in this collection that you edited along with Professor Lambert, you identify the Holocaust as the turning point in the fate of the Yiddish language. Millions of Yiddish speakers were killed, of course, but for those who survived, the language flourished in places where they settled before and after World War II. Can you talk about how this started a new phase in the story of Yiddish, particularly here in America?
Yeah, there are very few languages that have been systematically annihilated in the history of humankind, and Yiddish at least was a target in that sense. The Holocaust decimated the Yiddish-speaking population of Eastern Europe, what was called the Pale of Settlement in Poland, Russia, the Ukraine. But the first half of the 20th century was also one of astonishing immigration for the Jewish people, who very poor and challenged by anti-Semitism, had to look for new alternatives, and the movement went from those regions, Poland, Ukraine, to the Promised Land, what was Palestine and the United States and other parts of the Americas, also South Africa. So Yiddish irrigated itself worldwide. And the United States, of course, became the main magnet. Yiddish speakers arriving from 1870 to 1920, 1930, through Ellis Island, and then from New York City, spreading all over the country. The Yiddish language, in that sense, is a language of immigration that saw itself transformed, becoming Yinglish, the mixing of Yiddish and English that was striking for many of those immigrants that believed that they were losing the integrity, the beauty, the purity of their Yiddish language. By the third generation, some of the grandchildren had totally forgotten it. One of the folks that left a message in your machine said that for her, Yiddish was the language that her parents used in order for her not to understand, meaning it was kind of a private language, a secluded language,
well,
the
professor,
language for children not to learn.
Let me stop you there, because you make me want to talk about my own mother for a moment, because I was talking to mom about this very show. I said, oh, we're going to talk about Yiddish later on in the week. And my mom started to say, you know, when I was a girl, your grandmother, and I said, mom, stop. And I turned the recorder on because my mom had something to say about Yiddish and what it meant to her when she was a girl.
When I was a little girl, my mother and my Nana, which is her mother, used to speak Yiddish. And they basically only spoke Yiddish when they didn't want me to understand. And I got that message that I was unwelcomed into the listening situation. And I felt unwanted at that moment. And so I would leave. And I never really heard the conversations in Yiddish. And now as an adult, I realize that I missed an opportunity to actually be introduced to and learn another language, regardless of what that language was.
That was my mom, Helene Fonda of Bethesda, Maryland. Professor Stavins, I think her memories probably resonate with you.
They certainly do. I am a Mexican Yiddish speaker, believe it or not. And for us, Yiddish was a language of instruction. But for my cousins in the United States, it was the excluding language, like your mother was describing. It's funny because language is supposed to be about communication, about understanding. But for those immigrants, they switched to Yiddish when they didn't want the kids to know that there were financial problems or marital problems. And that created a sense of distance, but ultimately also created a desire to find out what it was. And there are many today that have that nostalgia for Yiddish and are teaching themselves or are learning about it because of that emotion that your mother so beautifully described of not having been included at the very beginning.
Well, when you talk about Yiddish in America, you have to talk about American comedy. And we're going to talk about American comedy after a break that's coming up. But before it does, Stephanie wrote to us on our Facebook page, there is something so perfectly onomatopoeia-like about Yiddish. Many of the words sound exactly like what they mean, even the rhythm of speech. It's wonderfully descriptive and comical. I think back to the Marx Brothers and Jack Benny, Joan Rivers, Gene Wilder, Madeleine Kahn, Mel Brooks, to the present day, Bette Midler, Larry David, Sarah Silverman, the best, says Stephanie. Josh Lambert, a lot of people, as soon as they think of American Yiddish, they think of the comics.
Absolutely. And I think that's very natural because we've been seeing through American popular culture and American comedy that comics will throw in a Yiddish phrase or a Yiddish expression partly to entertain a Jewish audience that knows that phrase and partly because, as your listener said, you know, it just sounds funny. It has a strange or surprising sound in the middle of an American joke. So,
all right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to talk more about American comedy in Yiddish. We're going to hear a lot more comics, a lot more entertainers, and we're going to hear from you as well. I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make safer journeys for everyone. For starters, all drivers are background checked before their first ride and screened on an ongoing basis. And now, Uber has introduced a brand new safety feature called Ride Check, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
The world is complicated. But knowing the past can help us understand it so much better.
That's where we come in. I'm Rand Abdel-Fattah.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's history podcast.
Every week, we'll dig into forgotten stories from the moments that shaped our world.
Throughline from NPR. Listen and subscribe now.
Welcome back to 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're talking about Yiddish and American culture with Alon Stavins and Josh Lambert, co-editors of a new book of essays called How Yiddish Changed America and How America Changed Yiddish. Here is a voicemail that one of you left in our inbox about your relationship to Yiddish.
Shalom. My name is Abi Levine. I'm a Chinese Yiddish boy straight out of Brookline, Massachusetts. Besides sarcasm and my father's perpetual aches and groans, Yiddish was a live verbal scripture tethering me to my roots in the shtetl. Phrases like gay kuk and uff and yum and descriptors like plunged make the language and its speakers inherently playful and irreverent. The first meaning, go take a dump in the ocean, or get out of here. And the second, no good, broken down. Oy veyes mir will forever be my tongue's Morse code for signaling a distressed psyche, along with aya. I hope that English will continue to evolve to integrate all the indigenous tongues from days old.
A note there from a Chinese Jewish boy in our inbox. And E emailed this. When I was a child in suburban St. Louis, my maternal grandmother started teaching me Yiddish. Then my parents found out. My mom immediately and in no uncertain terms forbade her, my own mom, from teaching me Yiddish. Why? The 1960s was still an age of assimilation into host culture for us American Jews. My parents were dead set on blocking any lingering ties to their parents' shtetl past. So they told my grandmother, we only want him to speak English. Josh Lambert, I wonder if that note that we got from E also sounds familiar to you.
It does, but it makes me think how happy I am that times have changed, that at the Yiddish Book Center where I work, we have programs for college students and high school students, and we have tons and tons of young people who are so excited to learn the language and have this feeling that it's maybe a secret that was kept from them or kept from their parents. And it's an amazing thing to watch them learning the language and discovering all this culture, all this literature, all this humor that they felt was being sort of guarded away from them.
Professor Stavins, you mentioned that you're from Mexico, and you mentioned briefly that you grew up speaking Spanish and Yiddish as a language of instruction. It's a fascinating story in the book. Can you talk a little bit about those two languages in your life growing up in Mexico?
Yes, Yiddish was the language of school, was the language that I used to communicate with grandparents and parents. It was in many ways the domestic, the private language. Spanish was the language of soccer, the language of the street. And I would sometimes mix the two, creating a hybrid, a mishmash, that in many ways is like Spanglish today, the mixing of English and Spanish for the Latino population. Yet I also knew that my teachers wanted me to use as pure a Yiddish tongue as possible, the Mameloshen, and that my non-Jewish friends, the Goyim that lived in the neighborhood, would not understand a word like Meshuge or Shmooze or Mazel Tov. Although after playing soccer with me and using sometimes those words to describe a move that I had made, eventually they also learned them.
So when we talk about Yiddish in America, we can talk about Yiddish in Mexico. Thank you for that, Dr. Stavins. Let's talk about the stage and entertainment, because Yiddish in America plays such a huge role in entertainment. We're going to talk about the comics, but let's go way back to the 19th and 20th century. Jewish entertainers who rose to fame in vaudeville, their shows where their ethnicity was at the center of the act. A lot of them sang in Yiddish during their performances, including somebody you may have heard of, but you may not know who she is, Sophie Tucker, a popular Ukrainian-American singer and comedian. Here's part of one of her performances, whose the title translates to Mama Goes Where Papa Goes.
The mama gay, be the tata gay, the tata tura lane is gay. The mama gay, weil sie versteht, als die was jetzt in Cheden ist gay. Wenn ich seh, die putze Häusen, die schäf sie ab, weiß ich schon, als der Teure liegt in den Kopf. The mama gay, be the tata gay. Allein wirst du bei Nacht nicht gehen, der Herr Schmerl. Allein wirst du bei Nacht nicht gehen.
Professor Stavins, help us out. What is Sophie Tucker talking about there?
Sophie Tucker is talking about the relationship between husband and wife and how one follows the other. The usual image that the father is the one that sets the tone, but this is a Jewish family. And in the end, it's the mother who's establishing the rhythms of how things should be established. And I love her accent. I love the music that she presents, and the fact that you're playing it on national radio, I think it's in itself a triumph.
I feel that way too. Professor Lambert, what about you?
Absolutely. I mean, Sophie Tucker was a huge star. I think it's easy to forget. She mostly performed in English, but she did songs like that she had done in English in Yiddish just for fun, you know, just to please a Yiddish-speaking audience. So it's a really incredible thing. And I can only imagine what my grandfather, who was a native Yiddish speaker, would think if he knew that on the radio today we were hearing Sophie Tucker sing in Yiddish.
Now, back in the day when most of this stuff took place on stage in theaters in Chicago and St. Louis across the country, not to mention the Lower East Side in New York, Yiddish was a huge part of onstage entertainment. And often the parts were played by non-Jewish actors, even if they were portraying Jewish characters. In fact, I did not know this. I learned that there was a concept on stage at the time called Jewface. It's an exaggerated display of Jewish characteristics and Yiddish speaking, often played by non-Jewish actors. Josh Lambert, can you bring me up to speed on that era of entertainment?
Absolutely. So, I mean, in the late 19th century, there was a tradition. You know, people are familiar with blackface performance, a very controversial and in many ways very unfortunate part of American comedy. And in fact, there was lots of ethnic joking like that, where people would pretend to be all sorts of immigrants or all sorts of different kinds of new arrivals in America. And one example of that was people performing as Jews, using their accents, using Yiddish words, in a way that was sometimes quite offensive and sometimes very loving, and that Jewish audiences really often enjoyed a lot, even if when we look back at it today, it would seem a little bit off color or racist.
Was it considered such at the time? Was Jewface considered a slight or a slap at Jews, or at the time was it understood to be something different?
There was disagreement about it, as you'd sort of expect. If you've heard of the Anti-Defamation League, which is an organization that combats anti-Semitism and racism, one of the reasons it was started in the 1910s was to clean up the image of the Jew on stage. There was such a concern about sort of stereotypical and offensive representations of Jews. But as Jewish people became much more prominent in show business, they were able to take control of the ways that Jews were represented. That doesn't mean that controversies went away, but it does mean that, you know, there was a little bit less of a sense of, you know, Gentiles making fun of Jewish people on stage, which, you know, was never something that people were entirely comfortable with.
Well, let's bring it a little bit into the modern era. Lorraine wrote on our Facebook page, "Mainstream comedians of the 60s and 70s familiarized me with Yiddish traditions, as did Leo Rostin's Joys of Yiddish. But since I'm a Zoftik Shiksa from the Midwest, Yiddish is not an active part of my life and often makes listeners pause in non-comprehension." We'll have more with Alon Stavins and Josh Lambert after the break. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Walton Family Foundation, where opportunity takes root. More information is available at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
Here's some good news. Morning Edition from NPR News isn't just for morning people. Now you can hear every story from the start, weekdays 7 till 3. Listen on your schedule. Just say, Alexa, play Morning Edition.
This is 1A. We're talking about Yiddish, and if we're talking about it in the modern era, I think we have to talk about Mel Brooks. And I want to talk about the scene in Blazing Saddles where a young Sheriff Bart, a young black Sheriff Bart, is at the back of a wagon train, not allowed to participate in the white move west. And as they cross the plains, the Sioux Nation comes over the hill, looks like they're going to threaten the wagon train, until the Indian chief looks upon the hero, Sheriff Bart, and his family, and then opens his mouth.
No, zeit nish meshuge. Laws im gain! Kappa walk, it's all right.
Thank you.
Big is in, take off.
I have watched that scene 3,048 times, and I can't get through it without cracking up. Professor Lambert, what is the very Yiddish chief of the Sioux Nation saying there? That was Mel Brooks himself, by the way.
So he says, Zeit nit meshuge, so don't be crazy. Let's not get out of hand. And at the end, he says, Abigazint, you know, as long as you're healthy, everything's okay. It's amazing. It's one of my favorites from childhood, too.
He says, Lazim gain. What's that? Let them go? Release
yeah.
them?
Mm-hmm.
Don't hurt them. Release them. Don't be crazy. There's no need to hurt them. Professor Stobbins, there's something else going on in that scene besides the Yiddish. Sheriff Bart's family is black in 1840, and they're going west. And when the Sioux Nation comes over the hill, they think they're going to get slaughtered because there's a war on. It's comical. Mel Brooks opens his mouth and speaks the Jewish language, but also says, don't hurt these people. They're just like us.
Yes. What's going on there is that there's an empathy between minority groups, relationships between those that are perceived as not being part of the center of culture. It reminds me, Todd, that when Christopher Columbus arrived in 1492 and heard for the very first time an indigenous language in Hispaniola, the island on the Caribbean, he and his crew thought that it was biblical Hebrew, that there was a connection with the past. They couldn't quite decipher it. Something that is remote, something that doesn't belong to us, but something that also relates us to a past that we all share. In Mel Brooks, it's done magisterially by relating groups that are seen as foreign, as if all of them have to be speaking a similar language or be conceived in a similar way. I adore that scene.
Yeah, so do I. I swear to God, I cannot get through it. I'm supposed to be on the radio. I'm cracking up something I've heard a million times. Well, let me bring up one more example from the postmodern, the current era, Yiddish and pop culture, the Amazon Prime TV series, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is a hit. It's about a Jewish family living in Manhattan in the late 1950s. It's full of Yiddish. Here's a scene from season 2. Joel Maisel, played by Michael Zeggen, he's at the bank with his parents, Moshe and Shirley, played by Kevin Pollak and Caroline Aaron. Let's listen.
Look at this, the high ceilings, the tile floor, like the Vatican.
I feel like I forgot something.
How are we doing here, Karin?
Why would a fakakta bank in the Tuckers of Brooklyn try to compete with the Pope?
I need to start writing things down, but by the time I find a pen, I forget what I was supposed to write down.
It's so open, so flaunting, so Gentile.
Jews use the bank too, Pop.
Show me one. Hey, you a Jew?
Pop, sorry. So, how close are we to wrapping this up, Karin?
Karin. What is that?
Just making sure all the I's are dotted here.
He dots the I's.
And I've got a team counting cash in the back. That'll take a while.
Only a goy dots the I.
Professor Lambert, there was only a little bit of Yiddish in there, but it strikes me it's not so much the words that are important. There's a lot of rhythm in that scene.
Absolutely, but I also want to point out how amazing it is that you can use Yiddish words that absolutely you could never say to your mother or father, and you can say them on the radio in America in a way that you could never say the English equivalents. So I wouldn't want to translate what that means in the same way that I can say the word schmuck, and we won't get in trouble with the FCC, but if an actual Yiddish speaker hears me say that, they're going to be equally offended as if I said a very taboo English word.
Of course, of course. Well, what does it say about representations of Yiddish that we're seeing in pop culture today, to this very day?
I think what that scene does, and what you see when you see Yiddish being used in a show like Crazy Ex-Girlfriend or in all sorts of other contemporary movies, is that there's still a sense of that history, of that American history, that Yiddish is part of American life, and it sort of always has been, or has been for at least 100, 150 years. And people don't want to lose that. They don't want to push it aside in the way that maybe someone's grandparents did 50 years ago. They want to have a sense of the texture of that American culture that they come from. And I think that's an amazing thing. And it's an amazing opportunity for people like me who want to teach that language and culture.
Cheryl emailed this. I'm an African-American Christian woman whose childhood years were spent in a Black and Jewish neighborhood in New York City. There, Yiddish was as ubiquitous as English and Spanish. Mostly, it was the elders who were fluent. But everyone in our community used Yiddish words. These expressions have remained staples of my conversation, and I value my Yiddish heritage. Sometimes the best words to truly express my feelings are Yiddish. Professor Stavins, those are the words of an African-American Christian woman.
It's beautiful, and it speaks to the glory of this nation that so many languages can be spoken in so many places and coexist with each other and borrow and lend, and that you don't have to be part of that language. You don't have to have the history that brought that language to this country. You can share it because you're a neighbor and because you're an American. And an American can communicate in English, but can also communicate in languages that she or he heard in the neighborhood. I would like to add one more thing connected with the thought that you and Josh were discussing just a minute ago. I think that a language is not only the collection of words that we have, it is really the sensibility that it brings along. And you can have so many shows like Miss Maisel or pieces of music or internet pages where you get the sensibility of Yiddish, and it's being filtered to it, not because of the words, but because of how it is being perceived. And I think that that's the DNA of a language. And I think the DNA of Yiddish has made it to America and has made it to the English language.
Professor Lambert, we're going to go in just a minute. The DNA of Yiddish has intertwined in America. How's the language doing today? What's the future?
I think there's a lot to be excited about. Resources on the internet are allowing people to teach and learn the language in new ways. We're seeing amazing publications. We're also seeing great translators emerge. At the Yiddish Book Center, where I work, we have 20,000 members across the country who are committed to preserving the language and teaching it. And that's a really, really wonderful moment to be in. There are, of course, lots of reasons to know that the language needs protecting, and that, you know, there were people in the past who didn't give it the respect it deserved. But I think in 2020 we can say that the outlook is really optimistic, and there's so much excitement about the language that there's a lot to be hopeful about.
Let me give the last word to our producer, Catherine, who wanted to share one of her favorite memories of Yiddish growing up. She writes, I was at my grandparents' house spending time with my grandmother playing Scrabble. The phone rang, and it was a telemarketer. My grandmother let them talk for a while, and then she yelled, Kishwein took us, and hung up the phone. It was shocking, and it was wonderful, says producer Catherine Fink. I'm going to make that the last word and bid farewell to Ilan Stavins and Josh Lambert, going about the business of preserving Yiddish, co-editors of a new book of essays called How Yiddish Changed America and How America Changed Yiddish. Professors, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This conversation was produced by Catherine Fink and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about the team, visit the website, the1a.org. As we go, here's a track from the 2018 Yiddish production of Fiddler on the Roof. It's called Wenn ich bin Rothschild, or If I Were a Rich Man. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillig. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A. Wenn ich bin a Rothschild, hi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a-bi-a
bin ein reicher Mann. Hand in kalten Wasser, nicht reingetan, Gott, was warft von Himmel uns der Mann?
Er beschließt, ich bleibe ein Ohrenmann. Was wird schön gestört bei dir, dem Clan? Denn ich bin ein reicher Mann.